Well, welcome back. Our next case is United States v. Black. Captain Seaton, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Marin, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Joseph Seaton, and along with my co-counsel, Captain Andrew Britt, we represent the appellant, Private First Class Ethan Black. I request 3 minutes in rebuttal, Your Honor.
Granted.
This court should set aside the Army Court's decision and reinstate the military judge's ruling because the military judge did not abuse his discretion. Specifically, the military judge correctly decided that Private First Class Avery did not have common authority over appellant's cell phone, and that even if he did, that the First Sergeant exceeded the scope of his consent, of Private First Class Avery's consent. And then finally, appellant's eventual consent did not cure the taint from that first illegal search. Now, turning first to the issue of common authority.
Now, can I ask a question based on that? Everything seems to revolve around Matlock and common authority. But there's another prong in Matlock. It refers to the common authority, the Supreme Court does, but then also says that third party has authority to grant consent if that third party, quote, possesses other sufficient relationship to the premises or effects. What does that mean? What's the Supreme Court referring to there?
Your Honor, I think that means that when they're talking about mutual use and joint access or control, they're referring to that as a type of relationship to the property.
But it's the disjunctive or that makes it sound like a second prong, a separate test for when the person can grant authority. You seem to be folding it into the broader ones, and I've looked at a number of the circuit courts. They tend to do that. Sometimes the courts, strangely, even though it's the disjunctive or, treats it very explicitly as the conjunctive and, which I decline to do. So can you expound on that a little bit more?
The way I see that, Your Honor, is that I see that they're categorizing that joint access and control or mutual use as a type of relationship to the property.
Well, when it comes to a type of relationship then, in Matlock, they weren't overruling or curtailing or anything like that other Fourth Amendment law. Where does the foundational principle of Fourth Amendment law, meaning an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy, where does that come in here? And does it come through that second prong or second test?
Your Honor, if I understand correctly, you're saying how does a person's reasonable expectation of privacy come into play with the relationship to the premises? Is that what you're asking, Your Honor?
Yes. So here, obviously, it's of import. If we're looking at the issue of the objectively reasonable expectation of privacy, when under these facts, you hand over a phone for 8 hours, you give the passcode, you write it down in the public area, you're not there, you're not monitoring it, you don't have anything password protected in your phone, how does this issue of the objectively reasonable expectation of privacy principle fold into this now?
When I think about it in those terms, Your Honor, I think that it gets degraded the further along you get through the Matlock test. So a person's reasonable expectation of privacy may be degraded if they give up joint access or control or allow a person to live with them in a premises and establish that relationship to the premises, Your Honor. So a good example might be a husband and a wife, and a husband's reasonable expectation of privacy as it relates to his wife may be degraded if she's there living with him, as opposed to someone that lives outside the house and is only an occasional visitor. That person doesn't have that kind of close relationship to the property, and in the husband and wife example, that reasonable expectation of privacy may be degraded. And I think that kind of blends into what Rader was talking about in this, when this court decided Rader. And there you had three roommates who all used the appellant's computer kind of like it was their own computer. And they did so for a period of 6 months. So in that example, you can kind of see that that reasonable expectation of privacy is being degraded, not only because they had access to the computer, but because they kind of treated it like it was their own computer, and they did so for a long period of time. And under those circumstances, it would be expected for someone like Airman Raider to make some sort of express restrictions on those property because of the way that the other people were using it for such an extended amount of time. And then here, we have a contrast where it's appellant is loaning his phone to a single person for a single night, and they talk about what are the uses of this phone, what was he allowed to use on the phone. Now, he certainly didn't expressly restrict anything, and the government points that out. But what the Army Corps gets wrong and what the government gets wrong is that there's no two-prong test to this. Matlock is still the test, and the military judge applied the correct test. He used the Matlock joint access or control factors, and he considered this court's decision in Raider, and he simply made a judgment call, and one that the Army Corps should have respected when he found that there was no expectation that Private First Class Avery would use the phone beyond those situations and those uses that they talked about.
Well, did he? Avery. Did he use it? I mean, assuming arguendo that this conversation took place, and I find the whole thing factually fuzzy, but assuming arguendo that some sort of conversation, hey, I'd like to play, you know, whatever game, and I don't know, check my email. Wasn't there some testimony that in fact what happened was Avery wasn't poking around looking for stuff. Something popped up and he tried to get rid of it. And when he tried to get rid of it, boom, he got a bunch of views of people's behinds. Is that what took place?
That was what Private First Class Avery testified to, yes.
Okay, sir. Was there any contravening testimony? I mean, I don't think so, because nobody else saw it, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so whether or not there's some sort of tacit, and it has to be tacit, limitations on this thing, and I find that hard to square with writing the password on the table. But assuming that arguendo, arguably, he didn't do it anyway, because all he was trying to do was get rid of this, you know, pop-up ad for, you know, car batteries or whatever it was, and go back to what he was doing, which presumably was within the boundaries of this discussion.
Well, Your Honor, it's not so much what he was actually doing at the time when it happened. When we're looking at his common authority, we're looking at his authority to grant that consent to law enforcement. So perhaps the fact that he was abiding by the limitations that they set forth when they had that discussion, he was respecting it because maybe he knew, and the military judge did find that there was no expectation that he would use it for anything else. So he was actually respecting that discussion. And just because it so happened to pop up, that does not give him the authority to then consent to law enforcement to search. It certainly could give him the authority to tell law enforcement about what he saw, and then law enforcement could go and get a search authorization based on what popped up. But that does not automatically confer that authority to then consent to law enforcement.
Captain Seaton, I could be wrong on the facts here, but please correct me if I am. But wasn't there some suggestion in the record, at least during Avery's testimony, that he thought he had fairly wide use of the phone, authority to use the phone?
That's, yes, Your Honor.
Wider than you might be suggesting here.
Well, Your Honor, the military judge quite simply took appellant's view as more correct. And he has that authority as the military judge in making that factual determination. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did, because their testimonies were more or less opposite. Private First Class Avery thought that this was a very limited, restricted use, and or appellant thought that. Private First Class Avery thought it was broader, and the military judge just went with what appellant said, and that is.
Can we rather than use up all your time and other judges may have further questions as well, can we assume down the line here, I'm not asking you to concede anything, but if we assume for the sake of my question that, first of all, let's assume that Avery had common authority. Let's also further assume that he had the ability to consent to the first sergeant's search of the phone. Let's further assume that the first sergeant, under at least our case law, may very well have exceeded the scope of the private search conducted by Avery. Now we have a constitutional violation, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
An illegality regarding the search of the phone. Is the next question whether or not the exclusionary rule should apply?
Yes, Your Honor, looking to Brown and the Brown factors. Mm-hmm. And the military judge also correctly decided that. He used the right law. He looked to Brown, and he looked at this court's decision in Conklin. And this court's decision in Conklin, as well as Darnall, there's a pattern between all three of those cases, and that is the flimsy and hasty investigation that law enforcement took up. And Conklin, in this case, are especially close because what happens is they get this evidence that more or less falls into their lap based on a sergeant's search. And they don't investigate that about what happened. They simply
you're saying that a reasonable investigator should have known there was something, to use a colloquial term that I used back in the day, something hanky with the search?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So they should have known, and so therefore, which factor does that arise under in the Brown v. Illinois factors? Is that flagrant conduct?
That falls under that third factor, yes, Your Honor. But just like this court decided in Conklin and in Darnall, this court said it hesitated to call the actions of law enforcement flagrant. I believe that was in Conklin. But even still, it was unwise, unnecessary, and avoidable. And the military judge quoted that exact language when he described the conduct of not only the first sergeant, but of law enforcement's actions afterwards.
So do we have any cases outside of our system where this kind of, I don't even know if I want to call it negligence, but unwise pursuit of an investigation rises to the level of flagrant conduct under Brown v. Illinois? But you know it. It's not a law school exam, but just that, if you know of it in your vast research, because I know you're a talented lawyer.
Your Honor, I cannot recall if there is any case where this court has found.
Not this court, courts outside our system. In other words, notwithstanding our decision in Conklin, are there any other courts that you're aware of that kind of use this unwise conduct on the part of investigators to satisfy the flagrant conduct of the flagrant conduct element of Brown v. Illinois?
I believe there is a Fifth Circuit case that this court cited to in Conklin, Your Honor. I can't.
You see, I'm trying to get away from it, but you keep bringing me back in. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. That's the case that comes off the top of my head is that Fifth Circuit case. And of course, there's always Brown, and you know that's what Brown analyzed, and you know those police officers' conduct when they did.
Well, their conduct was kind of more along the more classic view of what we see as flagrant police conduct, wouldn't you say?
Yes, Your Honor. But what we have here is the first sergeant specifically ignoring the advice and instruction to not tell appellant anything. But instead, the first sergeant goes up to him and says, as the military judge found, we have reason to believe that you're doing something on your phone that you're not supposed to. So the first
is there some requirement to tell the accused why he's being taken down to see the investigator?
No, Your Honor. And certainly when we're looking at this under a strict Fifth Amendment analysis, these things may have been okay under a strict Fifth Amendment analysis, but it's a different analysis. That flagrancy, as this court has found, doesn't have to be purposeful necessarily. It doesn't have to be malignant. But what they were doing, what the first sergeant did, combined with the actions of the law enforcement agents, just jumping into this heads first without thinking very critically about what they were doing, that violates Brown. That is still flagrant. It's that hasty and unwise initial investigation that if they just slowed down for a little bit and thought about what was going on, they may have come to realize that this search wasn't as good as they thought it might have been.
Okay. Chief Judge, I don't want to monopolize the time. I concede the remainder of his time to the rest of
Let me ask you a question. How does assumption of risk fit in here?
Your Honor, I believe that that assumption of risk is just a dependent clause to that first section of the sentence in Matlock. That when someone cedes joint access and control or mutual use over a piece of property, that person assumes the risk that a third party will consent to law enforcement. The government views it far more broadly than I think is appropriate. They cite a section, they cite to that in their brief, and they say that when someone hands their, I don't know the quote verbatim, but they say when someone hands their property off to someone and gives them access to it, they assume the risk that a third party is going to consent. And that swallows the entire rule, because if someone giving access to their property assumes the risk that that party is going to consent, then restrictions, even if they're expressed, don't matter. Because in this case, if we imagine that appellant expressly restricted his phone, he's still assuming the risk that Private First Class Avery is going to ignore those restrictions. So we can't look at assumption of the risk in isolation. We have to first
consider... Well, that's correct. And perhaps the government was painting with too broad a brush. But when you've got a situation like this, where you're handing a phone over, you're not in close proximity, it's for a known period of time of 8 hours. You're not monitoring it in any way. You're writing down the passcode. Why wouldn't the assumption of risk doctrine or concept apply here in terms of this was not a situation where you're giving your phone to your bestie for a couple of minutes to look at some photos. You're entirely walking away. Why did your client not assume the risk of what was going to happen here?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Since it's my question, please do answer.
Yes, Your Honor. I point most specifically to Riley, Your Honor. Phones are different. This is not the same case that Rader was. Phones are so different, they become so intricate to our lives that we have all sorts of information on there that are so private that Riley says that a search of a phone exposes more than a house. So we have to look at this in the same way, if not a greater way, than we do a house. If you invite someone into your home and you don't tell them not to go through your underwear drawer, they shouldn't automatically assume that you can go through that they can go through your underwear drawer. That protection and expectation of privacy from Riley is really the overarching theme here, is that you still retain that expectation of privacy.
Okay, thank you. Captain Mayer.
Chief Judge Oldson, Senior Judge Dukey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Carrie Marin, and along with Major Dustin Morgan, I represent the United States. For four reasons, the military judge erred when he suppressed over 4,000 videos and images of child pornography on the appellant's cell phone. First, Private Avery had common authority over the entire cell phone, giving him authority to consent to a search of the pictures. Second, the first sergeant's search of all of the photos was within the scope of Private Avery's consent. Third, even if the first sergeant's search was unlawful, the circumstances surrounding the appellant's subsequent voluntary consent attenuated any taint of that unlawful search. And then finally, this evidence would have been inevitably discovered, and therefore this court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court vacating the military judge's ruling. Turning first to the common authority doctrine, when appellant provided his phone for 12 hours of unsupervised usage when he left the area to go to sleep and was unable to immediately challenge Private Avery's use of that search or any other search. And when he wrote his PIN number on the table in a high-traffic area at the CQ desk and also placed no express verbal limitations, password protections, or any other technological impediments.
Counsel, so is that the government's position, that unless there are express restrictions placed on a cell phone, that the person to whom it's lent has complete access to the phone?
Your Honor, it's a one of the factors in the totality of the circumstances for the legal conclusion as to whether that particular circumstance arose to joint access.
So could Avery have called an Uber and taken a $100 Uber ride?
Well, Your Honor, Avery actually already called his friend Specialist DV as at Appellate Exhibit 4, which was totally outside the scope.
But I'm asking a different question. Yes, could he have taken a $100 Uber ride, just opened the Uber app and gone for a frolic?
That might not have been the commonly decent thing to do.
But it's the government position that he would have had that authority.
He could have done that.
And could he have opened up a banking app and transferred, or Venmo, and transferred himself $1,000?
Assuming that there are no password protections on your banking app, and assuming that somebody's not put these verbal restrictions, there are scenarios in which that person assumes the risk that that third party is going to go in and do that with their phone.
Then what has this court been doing in our decisions where we sort of wrestle with whether or not there was an implied limitation? And I agree with you that we found that there weren't, but why are we even bothering with that exercise if there's no such thing as an implied limitation?
Well, I think perhaps in the technological context, Your Honor, that it is wise to move on from a subjective understanding that this court wrestled with in Rader, because, first of all, to the extent that there was any understanding between these parties, it was unclear, which puts us in the Rader camp. And then it's just unwise as a matter of precedent to rest what the limitations are when those types of unwritten rules vary by different genders, by different generations, by different social groups. That was why it was an error and an abuse of discretion for the military judge to so heavily rely on somebody's subjective expectations.
I mean, so you just said it. We have to, the standard of review here is not your friend, right? We have to decide that the military judge abused his discretion, right? So what is it specifically, what law is the government pointing to? Or what facts that were clearly erroneous is the government pointing to that the military judge got wrong when he decided there was a limitation on the scope of authority?
The determinative factor that this court has always circled back to has been the degree of control. And the military judge erred because he did not look at the degree of control that Private Avery had. Instead, he looked at the subjective understanding of what the accused had. He said he had, quote, no expectation that Private Avery would go outside of what they allegedly discussed. But that conflicts with the law.
But isn't that the whole, we're going to Katz from the Fourth Amendment. Isn't that what the Supreme Court has told us? We have to have an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy. Did he not have an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy that Avery wouldn't transfer money out of Venmo or call an Uber, that he would just do the things that the military judge decided they had talked about?
Your Honor, under the facts of this case, when he left the phone unsupervised and left it for 12 hours and did not have any of the restrictions in place, to answer your question, yes. Yes.
So I want to make sure I understand your response to one of the first questions that Judge Hartle posed. You're saying that if the phone is handed over, that it's not only that the third party could gain access to their Bank of America account and transfer $1,000. You're saying not that they technologically could. You're saying that it would be permissible.
No, and I don't mean to put forth, the government does not stand here and argue that if I hand my phone to Major Morgan and I leave the room, that he can then just go in my bank account and transfer himself.
Well, what about the facts of this specific case? Because I want to make sure that I understand your argument, because it seemed pretty shocking to me. Under these facts, if PFC Avery had gotten into the banking app of appellant, are you saying it was permissible for him to transfer cash?
No, absolutely not. No, Your Honor. Under the facts of this case, when the configuration is such that the phone is sitting on a desk and a pop-up notification arises, and Avery attempts to swipe it away, and instead that brings up the photo gallery, then that is those are the facts that authorize Private Avery to have common authority over the photo gallery. Now,
in terms of common authority, can you, outside the military justice system, either at the federal or state level, can you point to any cases where common authority was founded on a one-time usage of the property?
The first one that comes to mind, Your Honor, is that Alexander case out of Nevada. And candidly, I cannot remember if the person who loaned the phone had done it in the past, but I don't think that he had. And I understand that's just a state case, but the law, court case law on cell phones is rather slim at the moment. And in that scenario, he did lend his phone to one of his employees, for lack of better terms, and then she used the phone and brought it to the police station and showed the police officers the evidence inside that phone. And in that particular situation, that is the court looked at how the phone owner, by not locking the things within his phone that he didn't want her to access, they used the term assumed the risk that then that third party would allow another person to consent to the search. And then I'd also point to Eugene. The analysis under, that's an ACCA court case that we cited in our brief, and the Army court there did the common authority analysis. This court affirmed, importantly, the facts for that is it's a husband and wife, so a stronger relationship than what you have here, but the degree of control was still such that they both provided the PIN or the password that totally opened the phone, so that the wife, although she had express limitations only to go and pay the bills, when she ventured into an entirely separate social media account and she found evidence of a crime, when she took that to law enforcement, the first sentence of this court's opinion, when you affirmed that opinion, said that the appellant's wife gave CID third-party consent to search to appellant's phone while he was away on a field exercise. And so I think that that is a bridge that comes to U.S. v. Black here, where the phone owner, under the CATS and the subjective and objective standards, when they make an election to loan the phone under these circumstances, then not only are they demonstrating that they don't have necessarily a subjective expectation of privacy, but that's not the type of privacy that society at large would wish to afford. And I understand that we're dealing with cell phones and a vast amount of privacy data. I agree with the accused in that regard, but I think that actually works against him in this case because it was such a reckless treatment of his own personal vast data. And then turning to whether he was able to...
But before we move on, I just want to make sure we're clear that the government's position is that the military judge didn't find any clearly erroneous facts, but the military judge abused his discretion because when he weighed all those facts and applied the totality of the circumstances test, it was an erroneous finding of law that Avery didn't have common authority to the entire phone.
It was not only an erroneous conclusion of law to find that Avery did not have common authority. That was erroneous. It was also an erroneous conclusion of law to rely on the accused's subjective expectations in light of the pivotal issue always being the degree of control and not mentioning password protections in his analysis once.
And the best two cases you have to demonstrate that that was an erroneous conclusion of law were the two that you just cited?
Rader is our first case, Your Honor, and then Reister with a logbook. I understand we're out of a technological context, but the court there focused and called the determinative factor, the degree, the access to that logbook. Gallagher also supports that notion where it's an unmarked and unlocked briefcase. Readily admit we're outside of the technological context, but again, all of these cases look at the degree of control that this third party had. And so when the military judge did not look at he said that he did not have unfettered access, even though literally in reality, Private Avery did have unfettered access, because as the accused conceded on the stand, nothing was protected, and nor expressly verbally limited, Your Honor.
Now, in that regard, you seem in your brief to draw a distinction between instances where a person says, you third party may do A, B, and C, as compared to a different scenario where the owner says to the third party, you may not do X, Y, and Z. What's the distinction you're seeking to draw there?
I think it goes back to the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment, which is reasonableness. And when somebody expressly says, you can use my phone, but please don't make calls, I've got limited minutes, words to that effect, that retains more of that expectation of reasonable privacy, as opposed to a situation where a couple buddies are just saying, hey, you can use my phone for 12 hours. Great, I'm going to get on YouTube, or I'm going to call my girlfriend, and it's not expressly clear. It's just a sliding scale, and it's just going to be, we're not asking for a one-size-fits-all rule. It's just more of the facts and circumstances of whether it amounts to the legal conclusion of joint access and mutual control in the context of.
Captain Marin, can we move, other judges may want to have other questions on that issue, but can we move to your second point where you contest the fact that, let's assume that there was common authority by Avery and he could have given consent and in fact did, but then your next point is that the first sergeant did not exceed the scope of the private search conducted by Avery.
That's right, Your Honor, because it's objectively reasonable when the soldier says, I found unlawful pictures, and he turns it over to the first sergeant. Despite the inkling, and then looking at photos that Private Avery had not seen, that under the law of consent, because Private Avery gave such broad, unlimited consent, that was within the scope of his consent.
Right, but didn't Private Avery only look at the photo gallery? My understanding of the facts is that once the first sergeant had the phone and he had seen the photos that Avery showed him, that the photo gallery was then closed and the first sergeant was then searching other files outside of the photo gallery. Now, you're saying that that's not beyond the scope. You're saying that's still within the scope authorized by Avery, the private searcher.
Yes, Your Honor. The facts here are that the gallery popped open to one folder within the gallery, which is an array of photos. Mm-hmm. And here it is true. The first sergeant hit that back button and went to another folder still within the photo gallery. And so when Private Avery then handed the phone to the first sergeant and said he wanted the first sergeant to know what the whole situation was, believing that there's additional misconduct on the phone, that was a broad, unlimited search such that it would be reasonable for the first sergeant to continue to look within photos because that's where evidence of that misconduct would occur. Now, it is true that the first sergeant had a notion in his mind where he thought there might be more things there, and that might be problematic in a different context, but because Private Avery already had common authority over the entire phone, when he turned around and said, First Sergeant, I want you to look at this, and when he placed no express limitations on his search, then the First Sergeant was able to look at the photos that Private Avery had not yet seen. Even if you find that to be an unlawful search, under the Brown factors, the chronology and the manner surrounding the consent that the appellant provided attenuates any taint of that unlawful search. And that is specifically why the exclusionary rule should not apply, because here the appellant enjoyed a full night's sleep. He got his telephone back. He was reading on the telephone with his jacket off in the sleeping area the next morning, and all of that happened without knowledge that his phone had been searched. So when he later consented to a search at the CID office, that is under circumstances where there was no taint.
Counsel, in your brief, in this part of your brief, you cite cases from all over the country that support your argument and your application of those three factors here. But the one case you curiously don't cite is Conklin. And I think we all know why, because Conklin took a very, what we'll just say, relaxed view towards those factors. Is it the government's position that Conklin is just inconsistent with Brown and the way those factors should be applied, or is it just, or do you have a different way to distinguish Conklin in this case?
Your Honor, to the best of my recollection, the government did cite and distinguish Conklin in our brief. And I do think that Conklin somewhat lowers the standards in terms of a lot of the Federal Circuit cases look to the flagrancy of the police misconduct. And even cases here like Darnall, where the agents surrounded the appellant with tasers drawn and then hauled him immediately down to the office to do the interrogation, even where it seems like that would lower the standard, I think the facts of Conklin are somewhat different. I do think that Conklin uses that but-for test that I noted in the brief that is contrary to what Brown and what this court in Kamsuk applied, so I do think it is a little bit inconsistent. But the facts of Conklin and the facts here are simply so different because you've got the sincerity on the record for the law enforcement agents here in the sense that they approached the magistrate multiple times. You have the accused's own words talking about in his own mind when he was sitting in the chair and when he provided that consent for law enforcement to search his phone, that he took a notion of, my line of thought is why say no in the first place if you're going to end up going and get a warrant? That's the record at 49. And so that demonstrates that his thoughts are free and clear. There's no gotcha moment or the gig is up moment. And so that is somewhat what happened in Conklin because they found the child pornography on the phone and immediately went to the DFAC and hauled him out. They asked him for consent to search first, which is not like the case here where they asked for whether he wanted to provide a statement, which the accused declined to provide a statement, and then granted consent to search his phone. And then, of course, you have this whole notion that there's no other evidence of wrongdoing on the record in Conklin. But here that's not necessarily the case because you've already had Private Avery see these photos of these clothed female soldiers. And as the military judge said in his first ruling, in a footnote when he was saying what the first sergeant, what you should have done is stop to go get a warrant because he said chargeable if in no other way. This is sexual harassment. And so you already have a scenario in which the government possesses evidence of a crime and they would have sought out and obtained an authorization of this, as this court looked at in Wallace.
Now, you assert that now, but that's not what the military judge found, right? The military judge found that there was absolutely no evidence that the government did any investigation or had any interest in any charges related to the photos of the clothed women.
Yes, Your Honor.
What do we do with that?
Those are erroneous conclusions of law because they are inconsistent with the record. And I will point to Appellate Exhibit 10, page 32, where the accused's own sworn statement, he admitted that CID was investigating these other photos. And that was in front of the military judge. So when the military judge found that they did not investigate the matter when given the opportunity to do so, that's inconsistent with what the accused said.
Is the accused the person in the best position to tell us what the government was doing?
Well, when he is asking questions, I think in this case that is a reasonable thing to rely upon. I don't know that in every case it is, Your Honor. And then, of course, you have this notion that there's no evidence that the first sergeant was going to seek out a warrant. I see I've got 7 seconds left.
Please continue.
I may finish. Thank you, Your Honor. It was an erroneous finding of fact that there's no evidence that the first sergeant would have reported this to CID, and I think it's critical because there is evidence. I'm pointing to Appellate Exhibit 6, Exhibit 4, page 2, where the brigade sergeant heard about those clothed female soldiers, the 134, and on that alone, no child pornography involved, brigade sergeant told the first sergeant, you need to take that to CID. And that, under Owens and under the inevitable discovery doctrine, is why the exception to the exclusionary rule should apply in this case, not only because law enforcement's behavior was not flagrant, but the routine procedures of law enforcement would have inevitably found that child pornography.
Captain Mayor, analogies in this area are fraught. You know, cell phones, we're still trying to, within the law, figure out how to deal with cell phones. Let me pose a hypothetical to you. Let's say that you've got children, you and your spouse leave, and you have an overnight babysitter. So you're leaving your house with all the types of things, or many of the types of things, you'd find on a phone. And this babysitter, in the course of those 8 hours overnight, proceeds to snoop around and finds contraband. Now, there's the assumption of risk that, in fact, that babysitter might be going through your medicine cabinet and all those types of things. But is there an assumption of risk that that babysitter is then going to notify law enforcement if they find contraband?
Yes, Your Honor. There is. When I invite somebody into my home and leave them with vast amounts of my private data, it would be the commonly decent thing for that babysitter not to go into places that I would find to be private. But I give up some of my expectation of privacy in that, and I also know in this day and age, if you see contraband, I am assuming the risk that that babysitter is going to call 911, and before I get home to pay my babysitter, there's going to be cops waiting for me at the door.
Further questions from the court? Okay, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. To go off of that hypothetical that you just posed to the government, there is a difference between that person finding contraband, notifying law enforcement, and telling law enforcement about that. That is acceptable. What's unacceptable is for that person to notify law enforcement and then say to law enforcement, this is as good as mine, and then give them that authority to go into it. Because what Private First Class Avery did the right thing here in calling his first sergeant. But the first sergeant, when he asked to go into that, he didn't have the authority to say, okay, this is as good as mine, and now you can go into it. There should have been a warrant, a search authorization. So that's the difference in that hypothetical. And we have to draw a comparison to houses here, because while the case law on phones may be sparse, we do have a lot of case law on houses, and we know from Riley that an expectation of privacy in a phone is similar to that of a house, and that's why we cite to Sanchez and Koss from the 7th and 10th Circuit, where they find that an occasional visitor to a house doesn't necessarily have common authority over it, even though that there's no express restrictions. So if we can apply this common authority rule to a phone, we should also be able to apply it to a house, and it also makes sense because the expectations of privacy are similar. But now moving on to the...
Counsel, before you move on to that other question related to this, could you respond specifically to the government's point that the military judge erred by looking at the appellant's subjective intentions and understandings as opposed to the objective facts about the degree of control?
Your Honor, it was appropriate for him to consider the subjective expectations because subjective expectations can inform a objective expectation. So he was considering the facts and he considered it as a whole and found that it didn't meet what you would call joint access and control for most purposes. It's just in doing that, that subjective expectation informed that. And he simply found that appellant's was more persuasive. And to the scope, the biggest problem with the scope is that the first sergeant exceeded the expressed object. When he was informed about what was on the phone, he was told clothed photos of clothed adults and children. And he saw that on the phone on that gallery that was open. He exceeded the expressed object of the scope because he had an inkling. So he went on a separate expedition because he had an inkling that there was something deeper on the phone. So that's when he violated that expressed object that we have from Jimeno, when he had his own inkling and wanted to go further.
Captain Singh, what about the government counsel's, on this point, contention, or at least the point she made, that, hey, Avery wanted the first sergeant to find out what the whole picture was. Now, is that, I'm not taking issue with what she said, but it wasn't clear to me whether that's something that was conveyed to the first sergeant at the time he had the phone and was going through it, allowing him to go to the next files. You see what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor, and I see that my time has expired.
I've already obtained permission from the chief judge of the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces.
You are correct, Your Honor. That was not something that was said at the time. That was
prior. Well, I'm not correct. I'm asking. I don't know.
Well,
I did testify.
Your Honor, that was asserted during Private First Class Avery's testimony. That was not said at the time. And the military judge found that what happened was the first sergeant was called down and that it was actually the first sergeant that asked to see the phone, and Private First Class Avery just simply handed it over to him. So it was the first sergeant who was seeking the phone and the one receiving it, and there wasn't much discussion.
Questions from the court? Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.
All rise.